Well, good day to you. It's Joel with The King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Hey guys, this is Dave Barnes.
And this is John McLaughlin.
And welcome to Dadville. Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome daddy.
On today's episode, we talk with our friend Al Andrews. Al started a place called Porter's Call, which is a nonprofit that offers free counseling to musicians and their spouses here in Nashville.
We have both benefited from this incredible...
Immensely
in this incredible counseling group. And honestly, Al was one of the first people that we thought about when we started the podcast. But we're excited you guys are here and get to hear Al's wisdom on all things dad.
Enjoy your time in Dadville.
Dadville. So this, I've known this wonderful bearded warrior. You can't say anything, so I just talk and you listen and smile at how much I love you and how much I'm about to brag about me. For, I think, going on maybe 15 years now, 15 or 16 years. He is a dear, 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 dear friend of mine, a counselor, literally and figuratively, kind of a second dad. And kind of why, I mean, John, you and I talked about this, kind of why we wanted to start this podcast was interviews with our friends like this. Mm-hmm. So Al Andrews is our wonderful guest. He is the founder and executive director of Porter's Call, a nonprofit in Franklin, Tennessee, here in Nashville, that has offered free counsel, support, and encouragement to recording artists since 2001. A 1976 graduate of UNC, University of North Carolina, go Tar Heels. He is a long life Tar Heel fan. He's a co-author of The Silence of Adam, the author of an illustrated children's book, The Boy, the Kite, and the Wind, and a Christmas book, A Walk One Winter Night, that I'm especially fond of. And this is my favorite part. Claim to fame is that he is mentioned briefly in a footnote on page 51 of John Eldridge's best-selling book, Wild at Heart. So everybody welcome Mr. Al Andrews.
Al Andrews.
Gosh. Hey, thanks for having me.
You.
Al, I cannot overstate how excited I am.
Yeah, I feel the same
talk
way.
With you.
Well, nice. Guys, thanks. It's great to be here with you. I've been looking forward to this.
Do not let us down.
Our expectations should not be higher.
No pressure.
This was a big reason we wanted to start this podcast was these kind of conversations, I think. And it's especially fun because, you know, like I think a lot of our a lot of the people we're going to interview and have interviewed are closer to our age and season of life. So something that we both got really excited about is just knowing that, you know, you've seen things.
I'm old.
Yeah.
So, yes. Well, also, I'm 64, and I have two sons.
You look good for 64.
Oh, thank you. I have two sons who are 24 and 21.
Mm. Yeah.
And so it's a different time of life.
Yeah.
But just
so much wisdom.
Well, some. But thinking about the kids that are your age kids was just a wonderful time of life. Mm. Crazy, but wonderful.
Yeah. Well said.
Yeah. Well, so I know you. I haven't known you for as long as Dave. Mm-hmm. I think the first time that I met you was at Dave's Christmas show back in 2012 or 13 or something like that. And you were reading your book, which I love. And then I came to Porter's Call, and you counseled me. Mm-hmm. I think it was the first thing that you said to me when we first met, which I assume you say to everyone, or maybe I was just a really extreme case that you had to pull this out. But you said, paint the picture of your house growing up. Which it was sort of, you know, I came in with sort of my list of things that I'm like, I need help with this stuff. Yeah. And you were like, no, I need you to tell me what your house was like. What did it feel like? Tell me about your parents. I need to know that to know anything. And that'll tell you so much. So that's where we're going to start with you. Tell us what that was like. Like, where did you grow up? Where were you born? All that.
Wow. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia. My family lived with another family in this huge house. My dad worked for the Presbyterian Church, and they bought this old mansion that was built in 1795.
Holy cow.
Yeah, and we lived upstairs, and a family of six lived downstairs. It was like we all had our own house. But we lived on a non-working farm that was about 100 acres.
Holy cow.
And it was fantasy land.
Mm. Yeah.
There were bamboo forests, there were lakes, there were just places to explore. And gosh, I stayed there probably from when I was four till I was in the fifth grade. Mm. And my best friend lived downstairs. So how good is that?
That is as good as it gets.
It really is.
It's like a Disney storybook.
Yes. Childhood. And we made tunnels in the bamboo forest.
Mm.
And
yeah.
It was quite a great place to explore and to be creative. And my dad had a workshop, a woodworking shop, down in the old garage where the carriages used to be in this old place. And I spent a lot of time down there with him.
So is that what he did?
No, he was working in men's work in the Presbyterian Church, which would have been, gosh, early 60s. Okay. And it was back before anything like Promise Keepers or big, and the Presbyterian Church would have a convention with like 12,000 men, and people would come, like Martin Luther King or the Secretary of State or something like that. And he was the director of men's work. And then for fun, he would just do woodworking.
Yeah.
And he set me up my own little table, and so I would go down there and do it.
So are you pretty good at that?
Terrible. I just did my little things. My sons and I learned how to make wooden pins. We bought a lathe, and so we've learned how to do a few things, but yeah. I wouldn't say I'm a woodworker, but I brought some of that with me from the old days. So
siblings?
I have one sister who's 2 years older than me. And she got married a lot sooner than I did. So she has older sons with grandchildren.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what was the dynamic with your parents, like, and you and y'all's family?
My parents had this theme that we're going to all be happy, which is good news and bad news.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing. You know, right. In terms of if you can choose being beaten or being happy, I'll take, you know, hey. And so we would have a lot of fun and enjoyed life and enjoyed adventures. And, you know, I can remember getting up with my dad like at 5 a.m. And we'd go down to this little lake and we'd go frog gigging, which, who in the world does that?
No way.
And we'd bring big frogs back, and my mother, bless her heart, would cook frog legs.
No way.
And she was totally grossed out, but she would do it, you know? Anyway, but that particular little time was just, it was adventurous. So they were both very extroverted people.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Both of them.
Both of them.
Wow.
And so people were always in and out of our homes, and it was a very place. And so, as I said, it was a very happy place. But, you know, the flip side of that is there was no place to express sorrow or sadness. And so that didn't go well for me in later life as that began to build up. But in the moment, it was quite a pleasant place to be. As I look back on that, I go, that was just a great season.
Wow. Yeah. Especially so was he, with his job in the church, was he super busy or was he around all the time?
He traveled a good bit.
Yeah.
But I don't remember him staying gone very long. But he did travel, like probably weekends or something like that.
Yeah.
But I do remember a lot of times him coming back.
You can remember
that. I can remember that.
Yeah, the reentry. Yeah.
The reentry, and that was real important for me.
And your dad, this is something that's always been such a cool part, and I think informs, well, you can tell me how much it informs your childhood, but your dad being a World War II vet. How did that, do you think, inform his parenting? Like,
oh, that's a great question. He, I've learned a lot about this guy. He died about 2 years ago at 93. And growing up, when he would talk about the war, it was kind of like he would tell adventure stories, and they're always really interesting and fun.
Yeah. Huh.
And there wasn't any blood in those stories. They were like, and then we did this, and then we did this. But then I found out later, he and I went back to Normandy.
That's
he
was, so cool.
He was on D-Day, like Omaha Beach.
Man.
Oh, my gosh.
What's the movie?
Oh, Saving Private Ryan.
Saving Private Ryan. He was on that beach.
So when you were a kid, he would tell some version of that story to you?
Yeah, cleaned up.
Yeah.
Cleaned up. You know, like, it was more like, and we were hiding in this alley. And it's the thing. So I remember that, but I describe it as looking through the wrong end of the binoculars at something.
Right. Hmm. Yeah.
You can see it's there, but you can't see the details.
Yeah.
But when we went back, he began to open up about it. And began,
how old was he when y'all went back?
He would have been almost 70.
Okay.
Because he was 19
okay.
when he landed on the beach, which is just nuts when you think about it. But he told me that after the war, and this is like a 19-year-old kid who turned 20, and he goes through D-Day, and because he was a little Tennessee boy and he shot at squirrels on the farm, he became a machine gunner. And so there are three people that do a machine gun back then. There's one guy that fires. There's one guy that takes the tripod. And there's one guy that holds the water that cools it. And when you talk about the war, the machine gunners are the people they go after first. So he just lost lots of buddies in that. But he also killed lots of people. And he went into a concentration camp and helped free that. And he was in Battle of the Bulge and all these things. And so absolute trauma, for sure, now looking back. But they didn't talk about things like that. They didn't talk about post-traumatic stress or anything. And when he got on the boat, he said that somebody came over a loudspeaker and said, okay, boys, leave the war here and go home.
Man.
And he did. And basically, how it impacted our family was in his life, and I don't blame him at all. There was a time when I did, but now I get it. He just didn't want any more pain. I mean, he had seen so much, and he'd caused so much, and he'd hurt so much. He just didn't want any more. And so he brought that home, and my mother grew up in a difficult place, and they married, and he just didn't want more pain. So he emphasized the positive. And I get it. I get it. It's not helpful to a kid who feels a lot of other things. But I get it. And when we went to Normandy, the floodgates opened for him, and he felt it.
Yeah.
And it's strange. The story that I tell is that when we went to that to the beach and to the beautiful cemetery, the white crosses that you see, it's just a stunning place. He didn't do much. It was crazy. CBS Sunday Morning was filming us.
Wow.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they went way down the beach, and they said, y'all just take a walk. And so we're taking a walk, and I'm thinking, this is where we're going to really connect.
Yeah.
This is where it's going to happen. By then, I'd been to counseling school, and I knew everything, you know, especially what he was supposed to do. And I remember saying something like, Dad, what does this feel like? And he said, it's great. It's great to be back. And he started talking like that, and I kind of shut down.
Which is sort of your dad's typical.
It's like, it's great to be back. And he'd say, here's what was happening, and he was explaining it to me. Yeah. And I was kind of going, whoa. You know, I had another thought about what he was going to do, which isn't fair on my part, but it was anyway. And then we went up to the cemetery, and he was quiet up there. But then we got on the bus with 15 other men and their sons, and we drove a few miles, and this guy, the bus driver, pulled into this place, and he said, now this is the German cemetery where the German boys are buried.
Oh, man.
Because you don't think of that, you know?
Man.
And it was in the woods instead of on a vista. It was in the deep woods, black crosses, five to a grave. Anyway, we pulled up, and he jumped up, and he was right at the door. And they opened, and this is a 70-year-old guy, 71, and they opened the door, and he burst out of the door, ran to one of the crosses, fell on his knees, grabbed the cross, and started sobbing.
Wow.
Yelling. Oh, and he said, "Please forgive me. I've prayed for your mothers and your brothers and your sisters and your children.
Night.
And I'm so sorry I had to kill you." And there's
I mean,
where
that brings me.
I know
tears.
it was like it did me too, and in him too, and all of a sudden I realized this is where it was. This is where he carried it.
Yeah,
and that it was his job. He had to kill people.
Yeah,
and it was what haunted him the most. Not what had happened to him, but what he had done to right. other people.
Did y'all talk about that?
We did. Yeah. We did, because he kind of pulled it back, kind of sucked it back up after a while, and he said, "I'm sorry." And I went, "No, Dad, you don't need to apologize for this. This is true." And I think in his later life, he opened the door to that, and then he began to speak of the other parts of the war,
wow.
and he began to talk about it more and feel it and express it. And then you couldn't shut him up about it.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Yeah.
It was great because it was the other, it was the full thing.
Totally like, different conversation.
Even saying things like, "I think about it every day."
Wow.
So in answer to the original question, I think it did impact because, you know, he didn't want more pain and wanted to protect us from pain. Mm. But what I did was I began to swallow pain and not express it or feel it because I kind of knew there was this little sign that wasn't ever in the house, but I could read it. And it just says, "We don't go there."
Mm.
If I hurt myself, they were very kind and would fix it up. But we just don't do pain.
Mm. Yeah.
So you grew up in this is the dynamic of the house. You leave for school and you go to UNC.
Mm-hmm.
Why UNC? What did you want to do there? What were you thinking you were going to do?
Well, you know, back then in the old days, it's so funny. You know, that was 1972.
Mm.
Everybody went to college.
Yeah.
There was no question about not going. You just go to college. And I lived in North Carolina. It's University of North Carolina. And so I'm going to go there.
Hmm.
And so I went.
Yeah.
And they were real glad that I went, and I went, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I majored in American Studies, which prepares you to live in America, which is what I have done.
So you've been
you're an expert at living here.
It's amazing how well I've done.
You use your major every day.
Yes. Actually, it's a great major. It's kind of a cultural approach to American history.
Oh, wow.
And bless their hearts, they allowed me to do it.
Huh.
And then eventually went to grad school. But
for the same thing?
No, went to grad school in counseling.
Oh, okay. That was
That was about 10 years later. But yeah, just went to UNC, had a great time.
Did they care what you... Did they, or did they just care that you went to college? Everyone went to college.
Back then, it was you go to college.
And they weren't pushing you.
They weren't. I mean, I'm sure there were conversations that I was never involved in.
Right. Yeah.
Like, what in the world is he going to, how is he going to make money? You know, and things like that with an American studies degree.
American studies.
A lot of people who took American studies. It was a pre-law major.
Oh, wow.
Or a pre-med major, because you could take some...
Pre-anything
major.
Oh, you want to do something
just
in America?
Basically,
take
you
American
want to do something
studies.
Else? Start here.
Are you an American and you want to study something after college?
So they were just fine with it, and you're at least...
That's
back
what they
then,
told you.
That's what they told me.
So you just mentioned this. There was a gap between you getting out of school, graduating UNC,
mm-hmm.
and then going to counseling school.
Mm-hmm.
What happened there? What?
I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
No.
NC.
No, just kidding.
That was Al Andrews.
And we've had
Welcome
Al's been great.
Let's call it the dark period. No, actually, I was involved in a Christian ministry called InterVarsity Christian Fellowship.
Oh, yeah.
And I went on staff with them.
Oh, wow.
And raised my support. And did that for about, 6 years. Worked at Wake Forest University and some Appalachian State. And then was a team leader for that. And then I worked in a ministry for older adults in First Presbyterian Church in Winston-Salem. It was like young life with old people.
Oh, wow.
It was amazing. It was
like, what? How old are we talking
about? We're talking 70 to 90.
Oh, wow.
So I was their minister. Yeah. And we would take trips. We would do these crazy things. But also we would help them if they needed to make a move from a home, their home, to someplace else.
Yeah.
And so we do kind of social work and that kind of thing. And then I went to counseling school.
How'd you go from old lives to counseling school?
That's a great question. Oh, I think during that time, I started going to counseling.
Oh, wow.
Because I was, 30-something, not married, and I kept saying I haven't found the right one, and I finally stopped believing my own press that indeed there was something else going on, and so I went to counseling to explore what that was, because I realized that that wasn't true, that it was me running from relationships, and I had a really good experience with counseling. And so naturally, I had a good experience. So I thought, I want to be a counselor.
Yeah.
Which is really not smart at all, but it worked out. But then
so I'm just curious. This is a side note, like, because I recently have come to you within the last couple of years going to counseling. Everyone should go to counseling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just, it's just a matter of time whether you reach the point where you realize you need it. Everyone, you know, would do well to go to counseling.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's very accepted to go to counseling now and all that. Was that the case back then?
No.
Or was it a big deal?
No, it was for me. It was a big deal for me, especially because we don't go there.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I probably knew when I went to college that there was just something that wasn't right.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about it. But the shame of going to talk to somebody about it was too great, so I didn't. So I waited like 10 or 12 years.
And was that something where you were like, I can't tell my dad that I'm going to counseling? That would be...
I don't think I remember that. I probably didn't, but I don't remember feeling afraid. They might have thought, wow, that's interesting.
Uh-huh.
You know, they wouldn't have said, what did we do wrong or anything like that,
right.
But they'd probably go, huh, that's interesting. It would not have been something that they would have thought about doing. Their generation didn't.
Yeah. I do feel like there has been a seismic shift toward the counseling sort of self-help psychology in the last, I mean, you know,
self-awareness.
That. Like, yeah, that massive.
Like, it's like, oh, I want to go, I want somebody to help me think through something.
Yeah.
And there are people that can do that.
There's no shame in that, I feel like, these days. I mean, well, that's not fair. I mean, we live in Nashville with a bunch of artists who are, you know, but and I mean, if you traveled, I'm sure the backwoods of Mississippi where I'm from, Bill, what's the matter, boy?
Yeah.
Oh, something wrong. Oh, okay, all right. So suddenly I'm a bad dad. You know,
just drink this and get back to work.
Yeah. But I do feel like it is a much more appreciated and sought after vocation than I would imagine then.
Yeah.
So you decided to go to counseling school. Where'd you go, by the way?
I went to Grace Seminary, and my mentors and teachers were a guy named Dan Allender and Larry Crabb.
Jeez, that's like the 1-2 punch.
Yeah. It really was. And they're no longer there. They went separate ways. But that's where I went.
Is that how Silence of Adam?
Like, Silence of Adam came out when they had moved to Colorado Christian University, and had a program up there. And I was...
Both of them?
Yeah, both of them.
Oh, wow.
And I ended up teaching there. And while I was there, I had a buddy, Don Hudson, and I started doing some men's conferences. And we joined with Larry because he had a name and wrote a book together.
Oh, that's awesome.
The Silence of Adam.
So funny, my roommate in college, I've told you this obviously, but my roommate in college had Silence of Adam, and I've read, I think either I read it or most of it.
Yeah.
Those parts that I liked, especially with this guy named Al writing them.
Yeah, well, shucks. It was fun.
Those letters are in red.
Yeah, they are. They're more of a pink, because you can't. That's two of them.
Like a salmon.
Yeah, salmon.
So
you mentioned, you know, being single, you go to counseling because you kind of feel like, you know, you need to work this out. So enters Nita, your incredible bride, who is also a counselor, artist, a poet. She's much like you, a many-colored you know, rainbow of talent, force. So how did y'all meet? Like, what were the sort of forces that came together for y'all?
Well, backing up to counseling school, when I went to counseling school, part of the way they did things there was, in addition to classes, you're in groups and you're in individual sessions and you're counseled, if you will. And during that time, all of that stuff that I had swallowed over the years began to pour out. And it was a very, very dark season in my life.
Wow.
And took a while to kind of recover from that, really. And
can I ask you this?
Yeah.
What made that dark, the repression of stuff for so long?
Yeah, probably a combination of remembering some things that had happened that had been just kind of pushed down. Mm-hmm. Remembering those things, but still carrying with me the old ways. In other words, there was a time when things were so dark, I wasn't sure if I was going to make it through the next day.
Wow.
And if you would have called me, and people did say, "Are you doing okay?" I might have said something like, "I've been better," like that.
Mm. Yeah.
Versus now, if I was feeling like that, and you said, "How are you doing?" I would grab you by the shirt and say, "Dave, save me from myself."
Wow. Yeah. You know? Wow, geez.
So even then, amazing, going through school, I was still committed to, I can't say everything.
Yeah.
So we got
it's
through.
It's like you're learning the things that you can't quite do yet.
Yeah. It was really an odd thing. So after school, I took a year off, and a dear friend of mine gave me a job working in a furniture store.
In North Carolina?
In Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Okay.
Which is not
which
my
forte.
Which you
could put your woodworking.
Well, actually, it was more like, do you like this piece of furniture? I'll sell it to you.
Oh, I see.
That you look like that you would enjoy this kind of Barca lounger.
Yes. It was this high-end, beautiful store. And he let me do that. And it kind of let things settle in.
Yeah. Mm.
And then during the middle of that year, or during the end of that year, Dan, who knew Nita and knew me, said, "I think you should meet each other."
No way.
So we met on the phone. Back then, people did that. There was no email. This will date me. You know, there was a phone with a cord.
Oh, yeah.
And we spent hundreds of dollars on the phone getting there. And we wrote letters.
Where was she?
Wait, yeah, where
she,
is she?
She was in Nashville. And
oh,
I
she was
in
here.
And I was in Winston. She grew up here.
So crazy.
And I was in Winston-Salem. And so we would call and write letters, like those things that you put in envelopes and stamp.
Yeah.
We would all write letters back and forth, and it was really amazing.
For how long?
Probably for about 3 months.
Okay.
And then I called and said, maybe 4 months. And then I called and said, "I think I need to come and visit." And so I flew to Nashville for a blind date.
I mean, that's intense.
I know. It was really intense.
Dude, where did you guys go for this first date?
Oh, you're going to love this. She met me at the airport, and it was like 1 p.m. And so she goes, "What in the world do you do with somebody you don't know at 1 p.m? So she had a little sailboat, and so she brought it to the airport, and we went right out to Percy Priest.
Jeez.
And went sailing. And then there was a storm. And sailing. And then there was a big storm that came, and we were blown across the lake. And all that. But it was a great. And then she had set up a group of friends to have dinner in case I was a dud, so there'd be a place to go.
I love that. So, yeah, I love the backup.
Yes.
Just really quickly, when Annie and I went on our first date, it was the day she graduated college, and she did the exact same thing. She had a backup plan that we were going to go to Square Books in Oxford, Mississippi on the square, and she was going to post up there and have her friends filter through. And little did she know.
I got 2:15.
Literally. So I got there. We went down to the square. We met up because I'd only really hung with her a couple times. And she was like, you know, we're having fun. She's like, "Oh, well, let's go over to Square Books." And all of a sudden, her friends just start showing up, which she didn't realize was like a chum to shark for me. Because I was like, "Oh, you have friends? Let me entertain them." You know, it was just literally they filtered through. And like, she was like, "I've made it terrible." Because I'm like, "Well, who are you?" "Oh, look, I'm juggling that. I'm
breathing fire."
Yeah, I mean, it was But I love that. I love that she's like, listen, girls, if something goes bad, I'm going to have a backup plan. We're going to meet up with y'all.
Yeah, yeah. So we did. And we were soaking wet from the storm that came on the lake that day. But then the next day, we went to Loveless Cafe for breakfast.
Got some biscuits.
And then we went to Davis Kidd and showed each other our favorite books.
Oh, I love that.
And then we went out to have this wonderful dinner. And then we went to see When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, I love that.
And it was on at the theater. And it was great.
Great soundtrack.
Great soundtrack. And that's also a movie where we could tell, oh, she laughed at that scene. That's good. Because I know that she's not stiff or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just an amazing. We had a great weekend. And then, gosh, we probably had 6 or 7 dates after that. And we got married a year from when we met.
Wow.
In Nashville.
Dave, you know, if you blink too fast, you'll almost miss February.
And blinking fast just sounds dangerous in general. Mm-hmm. A shorter month means less time to check off items on my to-do list, John. And you know what's really been a game changer for me?
What?
Policy Genius. They've made it incredibly easy to compare life insurance rates and save 50% or more in the process.
50%? Wow. Yeah. It sounds like you're going to have a lot more money to spend on stuff you really care about.
You know the fun stuff I care about, John?
Yep.
Non-lethal hugs.
Hugs.
Yep. And other people's swimming pools.
Yep.
You can say that again. Let me tell you how it works, Johnny. First, head to PolicyGenius.com. It's a one-stop shop where they tell you how much coverage you need and compare quotes from top insurers to find the best price.
That sounds like a lifesaver. Pun intended.
Okay. Policy Genius will compare policies starting at as little as $1 a day. They make choosing life insurance a walk in the park or a jog in the park, if that's your thing.
Yep.
You might even be eligible to skip the in-person medical exam.
Okay, but what about all the paperwork and the red tape? You know I don't like red tape.
Don't use those words. Those are dirty words here. The Policy Genius team handles all of it for you. If you run into any problems throughout the application process, they take care of everything.
I bet that's why they have a 5-star rating across 1,600 reviews on Trustpilot and Google.
March is right around the corner. If you're struggling to get stuff done, just take a deep breath. Can we do that together right now?
Ready?
Yep.
Are we doing in through the nose, out through the mouth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Now. Gosh, there it is. Policy Genius will help you make the most of the short month in minutes.
You're telling me I can save 50% or more just by comparing quotes?
That is exactly what I'm telling you. And rest easy knowing that your family will be taken care of if anything were to happen.
You know, and that's all a dad can ask for, huh?
And someone else's pool. Go to PolicyGenius.com to get started today. Policy Genius. When it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. So what is, like, because you and Nita as two counselors, like, John and I were laughing about this. We were sort of getting ready for this interview. Like, do you guys just sit and sort of counsel it? You know, it's like, you know, what did you say? Like, do you just come home?
Well, it's like, if you say the right, if you respond in the right way, does her eyes just roll? Like, I don't want you to go to the textbook right now.
I know.
Actually,
just to clear up a misconception. It's sort of like a doctor's children are always sick.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so it just really is not that dynamic in our house.
Yeah.
At all. I mean, it just
you're
really
spent
not.
By the time you get home.
We may ask each other some other questions, but it's just not. It's just not like, so it's what you're saying.
Nina, I want to say first, I hear you. I see you.
Oh, if I said that, she would throw something at me.
So what is y'all's dynamic? Like, what is it?
Oh, we're just very different. I don't even know how to describe it. We should probably get her on here to describe our dynamic. I'm much more extroverted than she is. But we've kind of learned how, like, she gets energized by being alone. And I get energized by being with people. And so instead of making her be with people or whatever, she kind of invites me into the world of silence. So she'll say to me now and then, Al, I think you might need to go to the monastery for a while.
Wow.
And I might invite her more into the world of relationships. I think we ought to go out to eat with some folks. We're very different, but we invite each other into each that. Other's world.
That's great.
Instead of trying to make each other, we did that for a while, for a few years.
Yeah.
I think she'd be much happier if she was an extrovert. Mm. You know,
I you know would be best for you.
So much happier.
She'd be so
change.
Much happier if she did life the way I did.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of where we've ended up. Where when we went to counseling together, he said, "You all need to be comfortable with the fact that you're very different, mm. and you need to do some things by yourselves, mm. and it's fine."
You know, yeah. it's funny. I think one of the biggest takeaways I've gotten through counseling over the years, you know, because Annie and I have done it. I mean, with you for a long time, we've seen a few different people here in town that have all been so helpful. And I think one of the biggest takeaways that I've gotten personally is that literally was hearing, you know, because I think as just a Christian man, I was like, I am the head of the house, and I represent our. And I need to make sure she's always okay, and I'm here to foster her relationship with God and mm. her relationship with the children, and all these things. And I think one of the most freeing things I've ever learned in my life was in the counseling room, and someone saying, "No, that's not really right. Like, mm-hmm. you need to care for her, and you mm-hmm. need to lead her to the Lord, but she is autonomous from you in mm-hmm. a lot of ways."
Yeah.
And it just was like this,
yeah,
you know, because I'd been putting all this pressure on myself as the husband to really lead well. And when she would have a bad day, somehow that was my fault, you know.
Or you'd have a bad day too.
Yeah. And so I think that was super helpful. And so, and I think it's really profound and really powerful. And I just want to I want to say this again. So everybody's listening can realize the profundity of this, that two counselors, not one counselor and a wife or one counselor and a mm-hmm. husband, two counselors went to counseling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like I think that's really profound and really wise. Because I think of you and Nita both as very wise people. I think, you know, I think if you would ask me, I'd say, now that's a couple that probably doesn't need to go see people to talk about their relationship, because you have two wise people who are both counselors.
They're like a self-cleaning oven.
Yes, that's right. You're just every night you just hit the self-clean.
There's just a 10-minute setting.
Hilarious. But you know, it's funny. Yes, thank you for saying we're wise, and we're also self-centered
very
sinners.
True. That's right.
And mess up things.
Yeah,
and mess up our relationship.
Well, I remember how profound it was sitting in your room talking to you one of the first times we'd done counseling, and you joking about how you had a jar that you and Nita always laughed with your boys.
Yes.
Anytime you said something you knew that was like, oh, he's going to need to get counseling, because you'd put a dollar in the jar.
Yes.
And I thought, that is hysterical.
Yeah, we called it the counseling. It was metaphorical, but we'd look at each other and go, whew, that's going to be $20 in the counseling jar. Oh, and because
what a great way to save.
There's so, really. And you know what? We actually told our kids this. We'd say, you know, when you go to counseling one day, first of all, I hope your counselor is kind to us.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because we tried.
Yeah.
But
we
can give you a list of things that we know we did.
We
just shortcut.
And it'll save you a lot of money. You know,
just walk in with a sheet.
Yeah, walk in
just
with a
sheet. Just give it to the counselor.
It's a worksheet.
It's a worksheet.
For your counselor.
I mean, I can tell you, like, there's a moment, oh my gosh, there's so many moments that I have that I go, oh, gee, I did this.
Yeah.
Or I said this.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And I go, oh my gosh. And one years later, probably when they were like 20 at 17, one of them said, "Are y'all really worried about that?"
Really?
Yeah. And I said, well, kind of, because, you know, people have to talk about their parents because they're born to have a relationship with God, and they get parents.
Yeah.
And
that's a great way to put that.
And I don't care how many books you read, you're going to fail them.
Yeah.
And they're going to have something they need to talk about. Mm. And so, yeah, it's kind of on our minds, but I hope they go. And they will, and I hope that I will be humble when they come and tell me what they need to tell me.
Yeah,
you know,
well, you said something to me in counseling that you had said to your boys that has been really important. I think about it all the time.
Oh my gosh, tell me what it was.
You said it's basically what you just said. You said, "Look, you guys were meant to live with Jesus. You got me, and at some point, that's going to catch up with you, and I'm here to talk when you're ready."
Yeah. Man, that's great.
So, like, did what, he say, a, did what I say a that true, or maybe that was
maybe, maybe
you
was said, Dave.
It sounds wise, so probably.
Yeah, maybe a lyric of yours. But what a great
yeah.
and true, and if you can swallow that and really own that as a dad, you know, because it's inevitable. You're either going to fight against it or just surrender
yeah.
to it.
Yeah.
That was a really, that was a gift for me.
I'm glad.
I can't you know. Think of a better gift. I mean, we've talked about this some, John, but I can't think of a better gift you can give your kids than being well acquainted with one's sin. Yeah. And having an appropriate view of your shortcomings. That's yeah. a real gift to your kids. Because yeah. then that hopefully spurs apology, which you've taught me is such a profound gift to your child.
Oh, I remember a time when Nita was gone for like a long weekend and the boys were like, oh gosh, 6 and 3. And she was gone from like Friday to like Tuesday or something. And it was like Sunday night, and you know, bless my heart, I was
yeah, you were deep,
I was
you were
tired.
Deep in it, yeah.
I was deep in it. I was tired, and I put them to bed and did the routine, and they came out for water, and I put them back to bed.
Instantly thirsty.
Yeah, because they're always thirsty, and then they had to pee, and then I put them to bed, and I think by the, I finally just sat down, and I had some kind of like. Dreamsicle or something, some kind of little yogurt bar that was just chilling out, and they came out again, and I just snapped. I threw the yogurt
yeah,
ball
you did.
Against the wall. It slapped the wall, and I just yelled, and they ran back to their rooms and just got in bed really fast, and I just immediately just felt, oh, my God. And I went in there, and they were just, like, really quiet. And I said, guys, you know, I didn't want you to come out, but there was no excuse for me yelling like that and yeah. throwing the ice cream against the wall, which was a little dramatic.
That was our last dream.
That was our last. That was my last. But anyway. And
his said, dad licking the wall.
So I said, so I'm really sorry, but I want to know how you're feeling.
Oh, wow.
And Brent said, I'm really scared.
Oh,
and I
my
went,
gosh.
Oh, no.
$50 in the bucket.
50. That was like 60. But anyway.
So this is what's fun about you being on the other side of, you know, where John and I are right yeah. now with our young kids. What were the challenges of having two different personalities, like fathering two different personalities?
You know, that's a great question. The personalities seem to make the shifts maybe at 13 or 14, and then they would explore different things. But when they were smaller, they would love to do anything I'd suggest. Mm. It became my job, that's a great word, but it's true, to think of creative things that would get them interested and do it and invite them into it.
Yeah. And so are they pretty close?
They are. Yeah. They are. There was a little season where they weren't. Maybe when the first one turned 13 and right. it's not cool to be friends with your 9-year-old brother.
Right, right.
But I remember almost the weekend that they became friends again.
Hmm. Really?
And now they're really close.
So was that kind of hard for you guys to see them kind of like?
Oh, yeah. There was this little year or two when we were going, oh, no.
Yeah.
You know, when we get older, they're not going to talk. You know, yeah. they're going to be those kind of whatever. Yeah. But they really love each other.
And how old were you when you had kids?
40 and 43. Yeah, my college roommate has like 9 grandchildren. Because yeah. he got married when he was 21. And I got married wow. when I was 36.
Wow. So was being a dad what you expected it to be? I mean, you had the unique experience of having a lot of time to kind of, you know, and a lot of schooling, and I'm sure you learned a lot about the relationship between parents and kids. Was it what you expected it to be once you finally became a dad?
I may have had schooling, but it didn't help. It's sort of like reading books on parenting. It helps you a little bit, but not much. But I do think that I gave something different to my children because I'd just been through a lot.
Yeah.
I'd gotten rid of, I'd grown up.
Do you think you would have been a totally different dad if you had had kids at 21?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, I went through a lot of stuff in my late 20s and 30s that they would have had to go through with me.
Right, yeah.
Including depression and all that. And they would have survived it. People do.
Yeah.
But it would have been very different. So I felt like as an older dad, I didn't have the energy to give them that. I'm kind of jealous of people that go backpacking with their kids because by the time I had them, my back hurt.
Oh my God.
So I taught my children that cabins are wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. Air conditioning.
They love cabins.
This Hampton Inn is right next to the trees.
But yeah, I feel like I gave them something different. Again, they're still going to have to go to counseling, but but it just was. I don't think anybody is prepared to be a father.
Right.
But I just, you know, when I look back on it, I go, that was really fun. Mm-hmm. And they remember it. You know, we'd do things like there's a day in our neighborhood where people put out things in the trash besides trash. Like you'd put an old record player out or just just stuff like that. And we would drive around and find things like an old TV, or my wife went crazy when we came home. So we would get out of the car and get the old TV and put it in the car. And anything electronic. And then we'd bring it back to our workshop and take it apart. And it was just amazing.
Oh, I love that.
So fun. Cool. We'd have pieces all over and just to take a TV apart.
Mm.
You know, and yeah, it was just fun.
What kind of dad would you say that you are? Which is a little bit of a weird question, but like, you know, what was it that you were trying to be, not trying to be? What were the, and still, and what are the priorities you have and had, and then not?
You know, I think one of the things that's been consistent is that I've always believed that my children, my sons, had a very intricate and complicated interior world. Hmm. And I think that's true of everyone.
Wow.
But I think a lot of people don't believe that about their children. And so I've always believed that, and therefore felt like one of the things that we've been committed to is to always pursue it.
Yeah.
Always. Never ask questions that can be answered with a yes or a no.
Wow. Yeah.
Like, we don't go, how was your day? Because that'll be fine, especially when they're teenagers.
Yeah.
And that tells you nothing. Versus, tell me something about your day that I wouldn't know unless you told me.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say we did that all the time, whatever. But, you know, there was a day when my son was about five, maybe four and a half, when one of his friends was killed in an auto accident. And I didn't know what to do with that. Because he's little, but he knows she's died. And so I would ask him, how are you? How are you feeling? And he would say, okay. Or something like a little kid would say. And then the next day, his stomach started hurting really badly, and we took him to the doctor, and the doctor said, that's where it is. And so I kept asking him, just, you know, whether it's laying down at night, how are you feeling? And he would be okay, and then I'd just say, what's it like? And he'd be okay. And I just felt like it was my job to keep pushing in. Because, again, I believe it's intricate and complicated in there. Yeah. And then probably the second day he said, are they going to put her in a box?
Oh, my gosh.
And I went, yeah. I said, why do you want to know? And he said, well, and then I realized that he had gone to what he was familiar with, which is Snow White. And that's what he'd seen. And he said, because if she's in a box, maybe I could go and kiss her.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, And then you know, my eyes start filling up. And then
this is the second time I'm like,
and then, wait, I'm not finished. And then, you know, because he's trying to put it together. He goes, I can go kiss her. And then I go, well, no, I don't think that'll work. And then he said, can God kiss through glass?
Oh, my
and God. I went, yes, and just fell apart. And he did, too. And I really could have missed that. And he could have missed that. You know, and it was this moment that, oh, my gosh, that he was processing it.
Yeah.
And dealing with it. But how easy it would have been. And I know I've missed a lot by not asking the questions. But to go, well, he says he's feeling okay. I guess he's doing okay.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, that just comes out, and that's in there, and he's 4.5. And they go, it's just stirring. So to me, one of the things is just always assume that their little minds are going and working and trying to put things together, and they're not simple. I mean, everybody knows that, but it's easy to treat them like they're simple.
John, it goes without saying that quarantine is totally a new way of life.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I know we're all tired of hearing the word unprecedented. I know I've heard it an unprecedented amount of time, but it really is. I mean, a year ago, I wouldn't have believed you if you told me that I'd be at home for the majority of the year with my family off the road.
I know. I tried to. I have a soothsayer's gift.
But we'll get back to that.
In so many ways, it's been a blessing. But in others, the stress and balancing act of virtual learning with the kids, continuing to write and be creative, and struggling to maintain relationships really begins to take a toll.
Now, how have you been able to navigate the ups and downs, Dave?
Oh, because God gave me you.
Hey-o!
And that's what they're there for.
Cash the check.
I wholeheartedly recommend Talkspace for therapy online. You can even start the therapy the same day as you sign up. Depending on the plan you choose, you can text, video, or send voice messages to your licensed therapist, so it's unbelievably convenient to have virtual sessions at the drop of a hat and from the comfort of your home.
Now, I know therapy can get expensive, so is Talkspace affordable?
Buckle up. We're about to go to the cheapest moon you've ever been to. It's a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy. Instead of waiting for an appointment, you can send unlimited messages to your therapist 24/7, and they'll engage you with daily, 5 days a week thoughts.
Wow. Mental health at your fingertips. That sounds too good to be true.
It isn't. And I have tried to poke a hole in this as much as you can poke holes in things, okay? Talkspace has thousands of licensed therapists with years of experience in over 40 specialties, including depression, anxiety, and anger management, to name a few.
Okay, so how can you sign up?
Thanks for asking, John. As a Dadville listener, listen, folks, you'll get $100 off your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com or download the app. Make sure to use the code DADVILLE to get $100 off your first month and show your support for the show.
That's DADVILLE at Talkspace.com.
Yep. DADVILLE at Talkspace.com to get support and save money today.
You know, when we were talking to Drew Holcomb the other day, he was telling this story about, I think we were asking him about traveling, and he has a daughter and a son, and I was asking him about if they prefer, when they were younger, did they prefer his wife Ellie over him? Because my two daughters prefer my wife over me, for sure. Unless I'm holding some kind of like a
chocolate
baked good or something like that.
Which is money. Why you go buy a lot of
which
vacations.
I do a lot. Yeah.
You have a copious amount.
But he told this story about how when they were on vacation, he had just got off the road. So he had been gone for a little while. And with their daughter, Emmy Lou, he was like, I'm going to take her out on a date. And she did not want to go. You know, she was really preferring Ellie. And he really fought through it and took her out on this date that she did not want to go out on, all that. And, you know, halfway through, she was enjoying herself and it was this great day and all that. So, but I feel like there is such a pattern of like pushing through this resistance as a parent, and maybe especially as a dad, although I'm biased because I am a dad, but whether it be like an outright, your child does not want to be around you at the time, or pushing through a seemingly like friendly end to a conversation. Like, how was your day? Oh, it's fine. Like going past that, you know, is where you really start to get into meaningful relationship. Yeah. One of the things I really wanted to ask you was, does it get harder to do that as your kids get older? And more pointedly, like, is it, you know, my daughters are 3 and 5 now, and I tell them I love them a million times a day. I'm very affectionate with them. I feel very safe with them. I don't feel judged by them, all that kind of stuff. So it's very easy for me. Is that something that is going to get harder,
you know,
as they get older?
I found it gets harder for a season, and that would be probably high school, the time when they're trying to break out and to find out what they're like, and they're pushing away from you, and that's just painful. And they will answer in one word sentences, one word responses. You just have to remind yourself over and over, this is what people do, this is what children do to differentiate, to express their independence. And they don't like you a lot for a little while. They're not, sometimes they don't, or they're just irritated with you a little bit, and vice versa. And I remember talking to some friends about it, going, gosh, is this going to be okay? And they go, they'll come back. They'll come back. And it was so relieving. And I've found that now it's even deeper. They are very willing, both of them.
Wow.
They're great guys. And we've even had a chance to, my wife and I have made the decision to kind of talk about our lives in ways about telling them some things about our past and our life and our marriage that they didn't know. And it was a conscious decision, and it changed the dynamic of our relationship.
Yeah. In what way?
Well, they just embraced it and asked questions, and I think felt more of a, okay, they're more real now.
Yeah, you guys are at that point where they are seeing, you guys are transitioning from just mom and dad to like, this was a couple that met back in the 70s. And the
Yeah. And they're still our parents, and they love us, and yet everything's on the table to talk about.
Wow.
Yeah.
And again, that may change, but right now it is. So in answer to your question, there'll be a season where you'll go, oh, no, there'll never be that. And then it'll come back.
So I can't say enough about Porter's Call. I mean, I have been
thank you.
So deeply blessed by y'all's ministry and contribution to this community. And I would really say this, and I hope you know how much I feel this, but I would say it's one of the most important things I think happening in this city.
Oh, thank you.
In our community, in the artist community here. And I know so many people that have just been so served by y'all's wisdom and input and time. But why did you do it? What was the impetus that made you think, gosh, this is something that I really want to do here in Nashville for artists?
Money.
Oh my God. And scene.
No. You know,
cash.
Cold hot cash buns.
It didn't start out as Porter's Call. What happened was we moved to town. I started a private practice. And at the end of the first year, probably 90% of my practice was connected to music.
Wow.
Because you're all crazy.
Amen.
Amen. But, and I really kind of was thinking, huh, is this just what it's like in Nashville, or is this something God's doing? And I didn't. It could be either. As more and more artists came, touring artists came in, the more I saw themes developing. It was the impact of being on the road with your family or your friends, the impact of fame or lack of it, the impact of lots of money or lack of it. And I'm not sure which is worse
Which
is more difficult.
Amen.
That dynamic that comes with people think certain things about me because I'm on stage at my best. and they believe certain things about me. Mm. And the struggle with whether I'm going to believe what they believe or whether I'm going to know who I am.
Yeah.
And having to keep secrets because if people know them, then maybe my manager will leave, or maybe I'll get booted from a label, or, you know, all that. And so having a ministry background, I was thinking, this 50 minute an hour and 100 bucks or whatever it was back then, it just doesn't feel like it's working for touring artists. Because one, most of them didn't have the money to pay, and I couldn't keep cutting my rates. And the other, people just couldn't come on time and couldn't come many times because they were touring.
Yeah.
So I just came up with this little entrepreneurial idea that I would go to 5 labels and say, hey, buy a day of my counseling practice and let your artist come for free. Mm. And the first person I went to was Peter York over at now Capitol Records. Mm-hmm. And I gave him my little spiel. I said, hey, your artists, you put a lot of money into them, millions of dollars to get them out on the road and successful, and we're watching them crash and burn. Mm. Would you be interested in spending something on their hearts and souls as well? And he said, well, yes, we would. And I didn't know what to say next because I had no plan.
You're like, we are off script.
I had no plans.
Jump ahead to page 11.
Yes. And he said, in fact, my board has challenged me to do that. And so within 6 weeks, they had approved. They said, let's try it for 3 months, and we'll pay you for Wednesdays. We'll buy 6 clients or whatever it is, whatever. And our only stipulation is you have to be able to accept any artist from any label.
That's so cool.
Which is unheard of in this community. And after 3 months, they came back and said, something's happening with our artist. Because I could sit down with a young couple who couldn't pay anything for 2 hours, which would have been $250, and for free.
Yeah.
And amazing. It was great. And they came back after 3 months, and he and Bill Hearn, and said, we think that our industry needs this. So would you consider being a nonprofit? And if you do, we would go around the industry and help to shake the trees.
Get the funding.
To get some funding in. So that was 18 years ago.
Hmm.
And they've been supporters ever since. And basically, we raise money from people who make money from healthy artists.
Hmm.
Yeah. And that's how we keep it going, because everything is free, and we want to keep it free.
Hmm.
So
I always think it's funny whenever I'm at an event, the last one being Dave's 40th birthday party, where we're sitting with 50, 60 friends, most of them artists, and I always just think, man, if Al could get up the microphone.
Oh, look, there's John. I see you over there, John.
All the secrets.
How's your fetish with feet going?
When I came to you for counseling, you had me paint what was my upbringing like, and we really honed in on my dad, mm-hmm. which was not at all on my little agenda when I came in. And we ended up talking about my dad, and I ended up discovering things and remembering things that I hadn't thought about in years and years and years.
Huh.
So obviously the impact of dads is so massive. What are some of the common themes that you have seen throughout these 18 years of counseling artists in Nashville?
Mm. Wow. I think one of the hardest things for artists is absence. And it comes with the territory. But I think one of the hardest things to overcome is having to be away. I've seen that as a theme over and over again of, I love what I do, but it's really hard to be away from my family.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's a theme or just a reality, but it's just out there.
Well, you even said, you know, your dad traveled a little bit.
Yeah.
But you remember him coming back.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, as I've told you, when I was younger, my dad traveled a lot. He was gone from Monday through Friday every week. And in the early years, he was still playing with his band on Saturday nights.
Wow.
And I remember one of the earliest memories of my dad is I remember him coming home. It was late at night. I was excited because I got to stay up because he was going to be home. You know, maybe he normally wouldn't be home till 2 in the morning or whatever, but he was home at 10 or something, so I got to stay up. So I was excited that I was up. He got home and he said, this will give you a good example of his sense of humor. He comes in the house and he, you know, gives me a hug. And he says, I got a surprise for you. And so I'm excited. You know, he doesn't normally come home with gifts or whatever. And I went out to his Ford Escort and he gave me a tube of socks, not new socks, just my socks. And he was like, you left these in the car. Those are just my socks. That was a surprise. That's like maybe the earliest memory that I have of my dad.
Yeah.
But it's him coming home.
Yeah.
You know? And we've talked about this a lot. Some of the memories that I have in my mind that are 30 plus years old now that I have, mm-hmm. they're so vivid and they're so seemingly insignificant. Hmm. Do you think that it's just the absence that gives it that weight?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so because your kids wait for you.
Yeah.
And so when you come home, it's significant. And I wouldn't want anybody listening to this, including you all, to think, okay, then I can't travel because I'm messing up my kids. Because that's not the issue. The issue is as much, I mean, you know, if anybody can travel less, I go, great, if they can make the money, travel less. But the issue is as much what you do when you come home. Because as you said, that's what I remember.
Right.
And it's funny, I hadn't thought about that, but I remember being at the back door when my dad came home.
Yeah.
And wondering either what he brought, you know, because he'd bring a little
socks,
something like that.
A new mom. Wait, who's that, Dad? This is your new mom.
Last week it was socks. This week.
It's Veronica.
Sasha. That was when he went to Russia.
That's right. She didn't speak very English.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, with kind of that thought, knowing that you sit with so many men, with so many dads, and with maybe it's a technology piece, whatever, but you know, here in 2019 and beyond, do you feel like there are new challenges to dads that are specific to this time of life we're living in? And if there are, how do you help them deal with those things?
Wow. I do think there are new challenges, and I really do feel like it has to do with social media. Hmm. And I don't want to sound like the old guy, but I am. But more than social media, it's the lack of being present.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a movie out called Eighth Grade by Bo Burnham. It's a week in the life of an eighth grade girl. And it's really all about the power of social media.
Man.
And there's some scenes that are just pretty incredible in it. But what it is and I wouldn't limit this to kid. I think it's everybody. It's people are not present. And so I think if I were a dad of kids today, I think my biggest struggle would be, okay, how can they still be cool kids and be involved in these things, but be present with people? And how do I draw them into relationship when they have these fake relationships?
Yeah,
all over the world, any place, and this fake personality that shows the best and all this. Right. I don't know if I've helped people through that dilemma as much as I see it as one now, but I think that's going to be a big part of the conversation, I think, because so much of people's security and insecurity is based on what they're seeing and how many likes they get or all that kind of stuff. So I think, but I think the big issue is being present I'm trying to think of what I would do now about, like, we had this routine at our dinner table was that we would turn out the lights and we would light a candle in the middle of the table every night for dinner. And the world would be closed out and it was just our faces. Mm. And, I mean, I know that if you talk to our sons, they talk about that. Mm. first of all, it started about, you know, you fight about who gets to light it and who blows it out. But then it just became this tradition that we did for a long time, probably up to high school, and then they were too cool to do it. Right. But for that little period of time, it was just our faces that were lit up. Mm. And metaphorically, I think you could take that somewhere.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
You know, that there's going to be some time out for these devices, and we're going to be together, and we're going to talk. And and that may be too dreamy. And
yeah.
It may not be able to happen. But as I look out there, I think, gosh, that's a big issue.
Man.
Yeah.
And for young guys, just the availability of porn.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's just, and that's just a discussion that you start having as soon as you think you should.
So can you talk about that really quick? Like, what does that look like for a dad that's trying to figure out how to talk to his kid about that?
Usually, you know, it's almost like, okay, you know that this is available and we need to talk about that. And the way I went about it was, you know, this is something that you want to do, and this is something that, frankly, I would like to do. Mm. And let's fight this together.
Wow.
And so that's kind of how I went about it.
Wow.
Just to go, this isn't just your struggle, little buddy. You know, this is a guy's struggle. We want to look at things we shouldn't look at. Mm. And so let's talk about it. So it was a conversation early on. I don't know how early, but probably when I first noticed that somebody was in the
you looked at that jogging woman for a while in the car.
I'm going to take my little iPod in here for whatever. But it was just a conversation because it's real. But I involved myself in the conversation instead of just them.
You also did something before we sort of bring it to an end here. You also did something that I thought was really, really profound. I've thought about this a lot. Was it when your boys turned 15?
13.
13.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that for a second? Because I think this is incredible. This was so cool.
I probably would have waited till 14 or 15 if I were to do it again. Mm. But we did it at 13. What I did was I got about 7 men that were friends of our family that they knew well, including my dad at the time. And I got 7 men that knew my son. And there's this park in town called Winstead Park, and it's about a 3/4 mile loop. And I asked each man if they would come to this park at, say, 6 o'clock and bring something, some small gift or token that they would give to my son as a representative of something he would need for his journey into manhood. And then they station themselves every...
Oh, I love that.
Around the thing and waited. And then my wife brought him. We did it with both of them. And then she drove off. So it was very symbolic, you know? And she drove off. And when he came up, and he was just so nervous. Both of them were. But I gave him a backpack and just said, so you're becoming a man. And there's some things you're going to need for the journey. So here's a little flashlight, and here's your backpack. And I want you to take a walk, and I'll walk behind you. And there's some men along the way that have some things they want to give you.
Man, a lot.
And so he started walking, and the first man just kind of comes out from behind a tree. And
scared.
And said... Hey, and then one guy gave him a book that says 200 things that you need to do before you die.
Wow.
And he talked about adventure. And another, I can't remember all the gifts, but they both remember them. But they went all the way through. And then after we finished, we drove back to the house, and Nita had prepared this really manly meal of steak and baked potatoes, and we just sat around and talked. And
I love that. Yeah. Isn't that great?
How cool. Where did you get the idea to do that?
I don't know. I'd like to say I made it up, but I don't think I did. I know I saw or read something about rights of manhood someplace, different places, and how it often involved elders or something.
Yeah.
And maybe, I think actually I'd gone to a kid's, I was invited to somebody's 13th birthday, and they asked us all to bring the kids something. We did it around there, and
yeah,
I just decided to expand it a little bit.
That's so cool.
And it was fun. But
so a few more questions, then we'll release you
okay.
to the wild again. But knowing, you know, I think a chunk of the people that will be listening to this are dads. Is there any sort of a great thesis statement, you know, knowing you have this moment in this podcast, kind of talk to dads, that would be, and it could be a couple of things, but it's sort of, you're like, here's the thought I have for the dads out there, which I know is, that's a big ask.
Wow. Well, I think it's one that I've said before, is that always assume that there's more inside. That's a big one. The next I would think is, don't let it get boring. You know, have a spirit of adventure and try to dream up ways to draw your kids into adventure.
Yeah.
And it doesn't need to be expensive. It can be...
It could be a TV that somebody threw away.
It could be a TV.
Don't take it apart in the garage.
It could be a ramp that you build in the backyard.
Yeah.
We have a movie of going over a ramp and it almost killed both of them. But, you know, I'll give you a crazy example. You might have to cut this, but there was an eclipse of the moon, and I talked about it all day, and it was going to happen at 2 in the morning. And so I woke the boys up, and I took them out to the backyard. And we're standing in the backyard, and they're really tired, but and they're in their little pajamas, and the moon gets eclipsed, and it just gets dark, pitch dark. And I said, boys, you know that in many foreign countries, when there's an eclipse of the moon, all the men in the village take off all their clothes, and they run around the nearest magnolia tree, which we had in the backyard. And they go, really? I said, yes. So we all took off our clothes.
I love that.
And we ran around the magnolia tree, hoping against hope that the neighbors weren't out watching.
Oh, my gosh.
And so that's still discussed.
I love that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be much. But adventure, just knowing that kids want to risk and they need someone to lead them. And, you know, I think the next thing is, and someone told me once, totally freaked me out. They said, no pressure here, but one of the things that people are going to think about, that kids are going to think about when they get older, is their image of God is often related to the image of their father.
Oh, geez.
Because you pray every week, our Father who art in heaven. And I remember hearing a sermon one time of somebody said, what are your father's hands look like? Are they always busy? Did they strike you? Do they embrace you? And people's first image of God is going to be what they've experienced. When they say the word father, what are they going to think about? Mm-hmm. If anybody hears this and starts feeling guilty, that's not where I'm going. But it's just the reality.
Yeah.
And so to me, the thing that I told you about yelling at the boys, there was an instance when I did something else. I don't remember what it was. But I decided that I was just feeling horrible about it. And so I went and woke up my oldest, who was more impacted by whatever I did. And it was like midnight. He was asleep. And I just took him outside, carried him outside, and I put him on his favorite swing. We had this big tree swing. And I just started pushing him. And it was just this quiet moment where he was just going up and farther up, and he loved for his feet to touch the leaves, you know. And I just pushed him and pushed him, and we didn't say a word. And then I just took him back to bed. And in my mind, what I was trying to say is God the Father is sometimes harsh. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he'll just wake you up and do something that you just love because because he loves you. And I didn't tell him that, but that's what I wanted to communicate. And that was intentional. Other things have not been. I think every dad I know feels guilty. And I'd like to make a sign of the cross to every father out there to go, you're going to fail, and that's okay. And there's a lot of grace for that failure. And you can move into that grace. To me, it's just a call to be a good man.
Yeah,
yeah.
Not a man that doesn't fail, but a good man.
Mm, yeah.
Because we all know very wicked fathers. Mm. And the impact of a wicked father is just almost unhealable, it feels like sometimes.
Yeah.
But a good father who tries and fails and succeeds, it's just what we want to be.
Yeah.
That reminds me of something we talked about in counseling that my wife actually said, Amy told me when we were going through something. She said, I don't need a great marriage. I need a real marriage. My kids don't need the best dad. They don't need a perfect dad. They just need a real dad.
Yeah. That's so true. That's a good word.
So with your kids, what is one thing that you want your kids to know?
Regarding parenting, I want them to know that I'm there and available and present and graceful.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's four things.
Hey, it morphs.
Gosh, that's a great question.
That sort of has been my takeaway, not only in this conversation, but in conversations we've had in the past. Even if you don't say this outright, you sort of, the message that I get from you is just a very peaceful existence. Hmm. With my kids, stop trying to get it all right. Stop feeling guilty about the stuff that you're getting wrong. Just be there. Just be with your kids.
Yeah.
You know?
Presence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Al, you're a ninja, man. I'm so glad you've been on this podcast. I really feel like I have genuinely been like challenged. Mm. I feel like I've learned things.
Yeah.
I feel very like, your point earlier that you reiterated, John, it's like, it just feels good to breathe because I do. I mean, when you said all dads feel guilty, I don't know if that should be the tagline for Dadville. Dadville, all dads
bring
feel
your
guilty.
Guilt.
It's true, isn't
but
it?
I do think it's true. Yeah. I think there's a real. I think one of the things that's really interesting, and I know moms struggle with a whole different set of things, but I do think there is, and we've talked about this, John, but I think there is this weird sort of inability that feels hardwired into a man. That's because our children's first instincts are not going to be toward us. They're going to be toward the moms, at least for a long time. Mm-hmm. So you're just kind of, you begin about a mile back, you know, like Annie's on a trot and I'm just like, just keep her. If I can see her, I'm doing okay.
There's still hope.
There's still hope. Maybe I can catch her. And so I think your point about that is really profound, but it's really freeing, you know, what you said around that about how you follow that up. And so there's just so many things. I mean, John and I talked so much about how excited we were to have you on, and I think you've gone
genuinely
far beyond what we felt. I want to say a few things as we wrap it up. As we sort of started talking about Al, you do have stuff that people can go and buy and check out and read. Boy, the Kite and the Wind is an amazing, amazing children's book that's really not a children's book. A Walk One Winter Night is an amazing Christmas book.
I love that book.
Thank you.
And if anybody ever sees Al is going to be speaking somewhere or he's been a part of my Christmas show for the last, you know, 7-8 years, you really need to go.
And it doesn't really matter what you're speaking about, your voice is like the shoulder, the back rub of voices.
Oh, that's very kind.
Oh my gosh. Where mine is like a nice knee to the groin. It's a solid, or just that kind of brush that hurts.
Mine's more like the annoying voicemail. Just,
oh my god.
You know, the monotone.
But thank you. So All you wonderful, beautiful, kind people, thank you so much for listening to the episode.
If you have a second, please make sure to subscribe, rate, and write a review.
Unless it's bad.
Because that stuff really does matter.
And please follow us on socials. You can find us everywhere at Dadville Podcast.
Also, you can follow us each at Dave Barnes Music and at John McLaughlin to find out more about our music.
Thanks for listening. Dadville.